Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's program is presented in partnership with the Lafayette Library and Learning Center's Glenn Seaberg Learning Consortium. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Lisa Vortebriggen, reporter and columnist for the Contra Costa Times and Bay Area News Group, and your moderator for tonight's program. It is now my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guests, former Governor of Michigan, Jennifer Granholm, and her husband, distinguished practitioner of business and law at UC Berkeley, Dan Mulhern. Thank you. Canadian-born Jennifer Granholm led Michigan for 18 years, starting in 2003 as its first woman governor. Today, she is a lecturer.
It's actually 8 years.
Oh, eight
Just
years.
Two terms, 8 years. 18 would have really done me in.
I think my eyesight's
That's all right.
Getting
no, I just want to make sure there's let there be no misrepresentation.
Today, she is a lecturer at... You certainly don't look as though you could have done it for that many years. Today, she is a lecturer at UC Berkeley's Goldman School for Public Policy and leads a national campaign for a clean energy policy that promotes and funds research and manufacturing for wind, solar, and advanced battery industries in the United States. Look for Governor Granholm on Current TV starting in January, where she will host a nightly political talk show following Countdown with Keith Olbermann. Governor Granholm and Mr. Mulhern also recently co-authored A Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Future. They will both sign books for your pleasure after this program. So let's welcome the governor and Mr. Mulhern, and let's begin our talk about your book. Why would you write a book, and how did your marriage survive co-authoring?
Two questions. Very important. Well, let me jump in, and then you can take the
second
question.
Oh, yeah, you always go first.
I always get to go first.
This is a clue of how this is going to go.
Yeah. Right, it's probably. The book is actually the story of Michigan, but it's really a story for the country. It's a cautionary tale. In fact, we believe that what Michigan experienced over this past decade, 2000 to 2010, is what the country is really experiencing now. And I say that because in Michigan, how many of you are from Michigan or know Michigan or been to Michigan? Look at all those great hands. So yeah, you all know that, you know, we have in our state been proudly the automotive capital of the world. And our identity was really wrapped up in manufacturing things. And so when we started to lose manufacturing jobs, and I was governor during this period of time, this book really talks about what worked and what didn't work in trying to crack the code to be able to create jobs in America in a global economy. So that's the reason why we wrote this book, is because we think it really is a story for the country, especially in this election year when everybody's scratching their heads and trying to figure out what is the role of government in creating jobs in an economy? What can we do as a nation? You wonder what this Occupy Wall Street movement is about. I think so much of it really reflects on the hollowing out of the middle class, the widening of the gap between the rich and the poor, and so much of that has to do with the movement of jobs away from this country. And so that's really why we wrote this book. It's a, you know, it's a book that's a lot of chapters of what it's like to lead an organization through crisis, an organization being a state. But the tail end of the book, especially in the final two chapters really, it gives hope for what the country can learn from Michigan.
Now, Dan, this book is in Jennifer's voice, even though you've co-authored it. How did that work, and how did it come out to be, in her voice? Where are you in the book, I should say?
Hmm. Well, I'm right there in chapter one, jumping on the bed when she
first
won.
Sentence, as a matter of
first
fact.
Sentence, yeah, jumping on the bed when she was first elected. But we were really a partnership all through, long before Jennifer was in elective office, and then certainly during that time. I was the silent partner in many respects, but my participation in the book really was for a couple of reasons. It is a governor's story and therefore in her voice. But one is it's a story of leadership, which is what I've taught and continue to teach. And it's about how do you deal with life when the fundamental assumptions have changed, when you've thought things would continue to be the way they've been. Which America now faces, as we all face that as American citizens now. We, almost everyone in this room, lived through a time where we believed in increasing economic prosperity for our children and grandchildren. And now that fundamental assumption of a continually growing pie, increasing opportunity, is at risk. And so when you are at the helm, as Jennifer was for 8 years, of a state that's absolutely shaking, trembling at its very foundations from these changes, what is it that you do? So Jennifer brings a public policy background and phenomenal experience. What I brought was kind of a look at, okay, systemically, what do you do? And it's also a very personal story, really, Lisa, about a person who succeeded at everything she's done out of, if not God-given talent and a great family, a work ethic that just does not cease. And so have some talent, have a great work ethic, know that you're, be smart enough to get a great team around you, which she did, and things work out. And in this case, they just didn't. It was 8 years of a grueling...
Except for the end, right?
They started to work right. out, but Michigan is still yep. in the bottom quintile in right. the state, in the bottom 10, and struggling as... Of course, our new home state of California.
We'll
is.
Come back to that, hopefully.
Yeah, absolutely. I know. Mm. I know we're going to have a lot of questions.
Wait,
about
can
that,
I so. Can I jump in here because
no.
This
yes,
whole
yes.
thing
can
about
we stop
your
you?
Role.
Does anyone think they can
wait
stop?
A second,
her?
Well, wait a second. Wait a second. So I marry this great guy, and we met at law school, and when he was growing up, he wanted to
be me.
That would be
yeah,
you.
Yeah.
when he was growing up, he wanted to be either Pope or president. And so he went to Yale as an undergraduate and majored in theology. He went to Harvard Law School. We met there. And after we met, he didn't become a priest. So, but he did become a saint for marrying me. But for him, there was a whole switch in what his expectation was going to be, too. And nobody thought when he was growing up that he would be the first gentleman. The first, you know, the guy behind the woman who is running the state. He thought that maybe he was one day going to be governor of Michigan, and it was only because we were being prepared. Actually, it wasn't because of this, but we were being prepared for marriage by a Catholic priest, and he said the Catholic priest in marriage prep says to us, well, what if the party comes to, we're Democrats, what if the party comes to Jennifer and says, why don't you run for office? What would you do? And you said...
I said, ah! I've married...
My worst enemy.
I'm marrying my worst enemy. Person I could never beat.
But
in all seriousness, I said I would be confused, I think, by that. This was long enough ago that there were still some certainly sexist ideas in me and in the culture at large. And
we've
I
been
would
married
be
25 years.
Frustrated, now. Probably. If... I, in the words I used that day, if Jennifer felt God was calling her to that, I'd be 110% behind it.
But now I laughed at the whole notion because this was
right.
not at all what I was thinking.
I
was going to help to get him elected or others elected. And so this was not going to be about me, but about, you know, getting somebody elected who could carry this forward. But, you know, as the time went on and the party did come to me to run for Attorney General of Michigan and then Governor, Dan ended up being in, you know, the spouse. And so
the
there
book
was
is a series of identity crises. The people of Michigan, some individuals in it whose grandfathers were auto workers, whose fathers were auto workers, who were auto workers themselves. You might even tell that story. And all of a sudden, there was no auto work. So it was the workers, it was the state as a whole, and in many respects, it was the two of us and our marriage. Writing the book was easy compared to 8 years of of being married to each other when the leader has on her back every day 10 million people and is struggling to make it work for them.
So it looks like we have an interesting divergence of interest in the subjects here tonight, and we shared it earlier between your personal experiences as governor and first husband.
Right. First gentleman, first and last husband.
Oh,
that's
right.
Never first husband.
That's right. And Ms. Granholm, you were the first woman governor in the state of Michigan, so congratulations for that. That's a terrific accomplishment. And the policy side. And so as expected, we have some questions from the audience that fall in both of those camps. So I suggest to keep everyone happy.
Let's go.
We'll go back and forth between these two realms. And as I understand it, the underlying goal of your book was to talk about how to bring jobs back, manufacturing jobs back to America. So we have several questions in here about that. What does it take, and from both of you, to stop this loss of jobs, as this member of the audience references, to China and to other parts of the Far East?
Well, first of all, I would say that we are not going to get jobs back. The goal of the book was, first of all, we have to recognize that particularly the low-skilled manufacturing jobs, they are gone. And we are not going to compete with wages that are extremely low. And let me just tell you a quick story. In my first year in office, by the way, when I was elected, the projections were in 2003, which is my first year in office, that we would see a big uptick in employment because Michigan followed the national cycle and we were just coming out of a national recession. And so the idea was that when the nation catches a cold, Michigan catches pneumonia because people aren't buying large manufactured objects. However, but when there is a great comeback, Michigan benefits from that. So the economists said in my first year that we would see that uptick. At the end of my first year, we didn't see the uptick, and I got a call from the head of our Michigan Economic Development Corporation, which is the economic development arm of Michigan, who sits on my cabinet, and he said, Governor, we got a problem. There is a major manufacturer in Michigan who's about to leave in a little tiny town called Greenville, and the manufacturer was Electrolux. They manufactured refrigerators. And I said, well, how big is Greenville? Remind me. And he said, 8,000 people. And I said, how big is Electrolux? 2,700 people. So 2,700 people employed at Electrolux in a town of 8,000. When you can imagine their grandparents and their kids, it is a one-company town. The whole town had grown up around this refrigerator factory. It had been there 100 years over various owners. And so I said to the Michigan Economic Development guy, said, well, we'll just go to Greenville and we'll make them an offer they can't refuse. We will not accept that they're going to leave and go, as they had planned, to Mexico. So we went to Greenville, and we put every incentive we had on the table. Zero taxes, state and local, for 20 years. Zero taxes. We would offer to help build them a new factory. The workers gave $30 million in concessions per year, the biggest amount of concessions. They were represented by the United Auto Workers. They didn't want anyone to tell what level of concessions they were giving because they didn't want to have to do copycats. We said we would do training for them, the local community college. We put together hundreds of millions of dollars in incentives. We basically emptied out our pockets, made a big pile of chips, slid our chips across the table to the management of Electrolux. They took our incentives outside the room for 17 minutes. And they came back in and they said, this is the most generous series of incentives we've ever seen, but there is nothing you can do to compensate for the fact that we can pay $1.57 an hour in Mexico. So they moved to Juarez, Mexico. Now, this was like a nuclear bomb going off in this town. And as you can imagine, in 2003, at the end of 2003, this wasn't just this town. This was towns and factories all across not just Michigan, but this country. We have lost in this past decade 42,000 factories in this country. And so for us, the question is, how do you crack the code to be able to keep manufacturing jobs or jobs at all. It's not just manufacturing jobs. It's other kind of jobs, too, in this country when the globe has provided new markets and obviously an opportunity to get very low-cost labor, right?
Right. And can I jump in here? And the important thing, I think, to understand, and maybe we all do, is that there really hasn't been a jobs problem over the last 10 years or so, that American corporations doing business abroad, well, they did cut 2.5 million jobs here.
In the U.S.
In the U.S. But there was a net job growth because they added 2.9 million jobs abroad. So it's not as though our capitalistic engines are not functioning. They are. They're driving growth, but they're doing what their shareholders want, demand, expect of them. They're finding the places where their investments will yield returns for their shareholders. Not only in manufacturing, by the way. How many of you read Thomas Friedman's book, The Earth is Flat?
The World is Flat.
Yeah. The World is Flat, excuse me. Yeah. And so I don't know about you, but the most shocking paragraph to me in that book at the time, 2005 I think it was that in 2004, 100,000 United States tax returns were being prepared in India. And that number is now, I looked it up the other day, it's up to 1 million just at Ernst & Young alone. One firm is processing 1 million American tax returns in India. So it's not merely a manufacturing problem. And the issue which does not seem to get engaged, and we hope will get engaged in this presidential campaign, is that we're not in the traditional cycle that we're in, and the traditional answers are not going
to
work,
so,
as they didn't
to get to
in
this
Greenville.
Question. So in my first term, I did everything that traditional economic theory would have you do. So I cut taxes as governor 99 times, small, large, targeted, you name it. By the time I left office in 2010, the size of Michigan's government was 48th per capita of all of the states. We cut more out of government by far than any state in the country, more employees by far than any state in the country.
Our Which should have done what?
Wait, just a second. Our corporate tax burden between 1997, my predecessor, and myself, and 2007, that decade, our corporate tax burden dropped more than any state in the country. So you would think smaller government, lower taxes, that we would be the most robust economy in the nation in Michigan. And yet, we had the highest unemployment rate. I was applying 20th century solutions to a 21st century problem. And the only thing that began to turn this around was when we got the opportunity to invest strategically, to be active strategically. So the federal government decides it's going to come in and save the auto industry. Great. That was very helpful. They had shed a huge amount of jobs. But not only did they do that, they allowed for us to diversify by providing an opportunity to build car 2.0, the electric vehicle. And so we said, our economic development team, we're going to create a cluster in Michigan of the building of batteries, the lithium ion battery for the electric vehicle. And as a result of the ability to use the Recovery Act money, and the ability of and the Obama administration's decision to save the auto industry strategically, that combination allowed for Michigan to rebound. And we're not totally rebounded, believe me, I'm not suggesting that, but it totally turned the corner. So in 2010, our unemployment rate dropped 6 times faster than the national average. Bloomberg 2 weeks ago said that Michigan's economy in the past year and a half outperformed 48 other states. Newsweek declared that it was the number one place for job creation. Today, the Center for Automotive Research says that there's going to be 60,000 new jobs created in the automotive industry this year coming up. The bottom line is that it was only because of active strategic intervention, not hands off, but intervention that allowed for us to stabilize and start to rebound.
Now, you come from Michigan, the auto capital of the world, and public sentiment, as we're hearing around the country, anti-bailout of banks, anti-bailout of auto companies. Can you talk about what you learned in Michigan about the bailouts and how it applies maybe in California, maybe even nationally? We have a question here about whether or not there should be a national, you know, huge infrastructure program funded by the federal government, which would again be described by probably Republicans and some of the Wall Street folks as unnecessary bailouts.
I'll jump in, I guess, first. When it comes to manufacturing, the cost of letting GM and Chrysler go would have been absolutely devastating for this country. It wouldn't have been those two companies alone, but it would have been huge numbers of suppliers and all kinds of technology, as Jennifer will be quick to add and say more articulately than I. The car is the most sophisticated technological product that we have. There is so much technology in an automobile, it's unbelievable. If you move all of that, and if you lose the ability to make things, to be there, to get your hands on it, to see how it fits together, you're losing things up and down the supply chain that are absolutely extraordinary. So I think it was extremely important that we did it. I want to go to the bigger issue, and then, Jen, you may want to jump in here. And back to that first question, what is it that we do? And the point that we're trying to make in the book is that we're still stuck in a very crazy old way of looking at things. And there is still a critique that says, take your hands off and let the market go. Let the invisible hand do its thing and get government as far away from it as you possibly can. In that instance of GM and Chrysler, they would have been gone. They would have been in liquidation. They would have been split into pieces. They would have been bought. The pieces of them that are nice would have been bought by lots of people, and a lot of it just would have absolutely disappeared. But the point is that I want to make is that we're living in a global economy where businesses, as the eminent philosopher John Stewart has said, quoting Mitt Romney, corporations are persons, they're just not American people. Their interest is in investing, and I don't say that with any moral judgment. It just is what it is. Their job is to invest and bring money back to their shareholders. That doesn't mean there can't be a different conversation about what a successful company is and ask about what a GM American citizen would be like or a citizen of the world would be like, but their bottom line is to produce for people. Well, other countries around the globe understand this, and they're in a very different relationship to their businesses. I'll let you talk about Singapore, which is a great example. But if you look at China and compare what's happening with American investment in China to what's happening with Japanese investment in America, it looks like this. Toyota comes to America and they say, Tennessee, what can you give us? Mississippi, what can you give us? Steve Falk, you're the manager of Lafayette. Can you give us anything? Bring Jerry Brown in. What can he give us? And we'll give you some jobs. And they invest somewhere. They get these states to bid against each other and they invest. Now, GM goes to China and says, China, we want to invest here. What can you do for us? And China says, well, we've got some land, we've got some cheap labor for you, and here's the deal. Come to Shanghai. Shanghai will own half of your company. It's called Shanghai Motors. The returns will go to Shanghai. The city of Shanghai is working in part of China's plan. I'm not saying we want necessarily a nationalized, centralized government, but China has a growth plan. Shanghai's working that plan. And you grow and do well here, and we all win. You get some profits you can take back to America. We get tons of jobs, which we're pretty geeked about. And Shanghai Motors gets half the income. It's a very different strategy. So we're going to see a campaign in the next year that's going to demonize government, say government has no role. And Jennifer, why don't you tell a story about Singapore and a story about China to get a sense of how the rest of the world is playing this game? It's very different than what people would have us play the game.
I was moderating a panel of American multinational CEOs earlier this year, and the question that the panel was discussing was what should be the role of government in creating jobs in the United States? And the CEOs who were the CEO of Coca-Cola, the CEO of AT&T, the CEO of John Deere, I mean, big CEOs. And I said, what country does this best? Who should we be emulating? And to a person, they all said Singapore. And I said, why? What is it that Singapore is doing? What should we be doing that Singapore is doing? And what they said was, first of all, Singapore has done an analysis of its strengths, its weaknesses, its opportunities, and its threats. It's called a SWOT analysis. They identify the kinds of businesses that will be successful inside of Singapore. Singapore is adjacent to all sorts of water. They're really focused on logistics. And then they go after the international companies that will succeed inside of Singapore. And they make it easy. They streamline permitting. They offer access to capital so they can get their technology and equipment in the ground. They have a full-throated partnership with the businesses who decide to come there. And I said to them, wow, it sounds like an active role for government. And while they're all American CEOs, you know, the minute you start talking about active government, that gets them nervous. But the reality is, yes, the Singaporean government has a strategy and they're active. It's not huge government, but it's active strategic government.
Isn't that what you were doing?
Let me just quickly finish this up by telling the China story, and then we'll get back to this. But wait a second. So then I was in China in March, and I was with a group called Securing America's Future Energy, and we went to China to find out what are they doing to be able to attract so many solar panel companies. I mean, California has lost a huge number of them, as you probably are aware, to the Chinese government. So they were bragging about all of the great stuff that they had been doing, and they were, in fact, were very successful. And in the middle of one meeting, one of the Chinese officials, somebody was presenting, pulls me aside, and he says, so when do you think the United States is going to get a national energy policy? And I said, oh, my gosh, the Tea Party, the divisiveness in Congress, I just don't know when it's going to happen. And this is what the Chinese official did. He goes, he says, take your time. Why? Because they see our passivity as their opportunity. And it's not just China. It's not just Singapore. It's Germany. It's Sweden. It's all of these other countries who understand that they have got to play an active role in making businesses competitive inside of their countries. We have not played that role. All we're doing is these states are competing one against another. So I'm coming to California to lure businesses from Silicon Valley, telling all of these guys, if you want to take your product, your idea to scale, come to Michigan, and we'll put all these tax incentives on the table. And then, you know, Governor Perry from Texas is, we're arm wrestling over this company A or company B. And every month I'm standing up in front of the TV cameras in Michigan saying, we got 40 companies from this state and this state and this state with all these tax incentives. But what a stupid national strategy that is. Because all you're doing is moving, right, businesses around. You're moving the chairs around on the deck of the Titanic. But states alone do not have the resources to compete against China or against Germany or against Singapore. We alone can't do it. Arnold Schwarzenegger and I both did a huge amount of traveling to go get businesses to come. It's the lowest hanging fruit. It's great stuff to be able to go to see mid-sized businesses in other countries and say, come, we'll make it easy for you to do business in the United States. We should have every U.S. ambassador who is tasked with goals of getting a certain number of international companies to come to the United States to hire our citizens. It's the easiest thing to do, but alone every state has no resources to be able to put on the table to compete against these big countries. And that is the point of this book, is that we have to have, in partnership with local units of government and with states, a uniquely American active economic development strategy, because hands off, if we go down that road, we are going to continue to see the demise of factories, of jobs. We're going to continue to see the loss. And that, if you want to see Occupy Wall Street go crazy, that is going to perpetuate the unrest in this country.
Now, I want to get to corporations, but first we have to do a radio announcement. You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Our guests today are Jennifer Granholm, former governor of Michigan, and Dan Mulhern, her husband and co-author of their new book, A Governor's Story, The Fight for Jobs and America's Economic Future. And I'm Lisa Vorderbriggen with the Contra Costa Times. So let's go back to, you talked a lot about countries and the role of countries in government. And there's a question here about the role of corporations. Corporations are now being heavily demonized in the Occupy movement. What role do you see corporations, corporate greed, the corporate economic and fiscal picture with how the role in our economic decline?
Well, I think we've sort of answered that in a big way, which is that corporations are largely amoral. Their job is to grow, and providing jobs is a moral thing, as any business person knows. When you sign somebody's paycheck and you know they're supporting their family, that's a great thing. But they don't have any patriotic way of being. And, here's the problem from a tax standpoint is, the right continues to say cut taxes and don't touch the millionaires or the billionaires or the 1%. Eliminate the capital gains tax. Well, if you think about it for a minute, if we eliminate the capital gains tax completely so that any money that you make on an investment, you don't pay income tax on that, we will certainly promote investment, right? People are going to invest knowing that there's going to be less taxation on their investment, better to invest maybe than to spend the money. But where is that money going to go given the state of the current global economy? It's probably not going to go to Greece, probably not going to go to Italy right now, right? They're having a heck of a time finding money. So where do we think that money is going to go?
They're going to invest in multinational corporations who are going to then, in turn, invest where they can get the biggest return for their shareholders. And where is that? It's not going to be in the U.S., right? It's right. Going to be taking advantage of growing markets elsewhere. And so we have to realize that tax policy has to be tied to job creation in America. If you just willy-nilly cut taxes across the board, you are providing extra income for investors and corporations to invest, but that investment is not going to occur here. So without tying it to job creation here, we may be facilitating the flight of jobs and capital.
Yeah, and
elsewhere.
Somebody asked about infrastructure spending. If you think about it, infrastructure spending is a pretty darn good bet. Because every penny that you're spending on the roads here, every penny you're spending on the bridge, every person you're getting to work in that tunnel to get that new tunnel going, that money's largely going to be spent here, right? It's a pretty darn good thing, pretty darn good idea. And with modern public-private partnerships, it's not like Steve Falk is going to go out and hire 50 of his buddies to go work in the tunnel. He's going to bid the job if he's the public servant, and there are going to be private sector companies aggressively competing and doing what they do well, hopefully driving down price and driving up quality. In a public-private partnership, you're getting a high level of investment return. What's the biggest thing that we can do? Invest in our people. Because if we don't invest in our brain power, we're in big trouble. As Jennifer was saying earlier, we're not going to compete with Juarez, Mexico, when Electrolux comes along and says, okay, Jen, they're paying $1.57 an hour. What can the UAW do for me now? Now the UAW signed a deal under the pressure where they have two-tier wages. So they still have older folks in their system making $25, $30, $40 an hour, and new people are coming in at $10, $12 an hour, enough to survive. Not a bad thing. So we're getting lean and we're getting competitive, and that's a good thing. But we don't want to compete with Juarez, Mexico. So what do we need to have? We need to have an incredibly educated workforce, and we need to have really progressive management where people are upskilling their folks all the time.
Let me just say, too, I strongly believe that we have to have advanced manufacturing in this country. And if we lose the ability, as Dan says, to make things, we also lose the ability to engineer them, because you cannot separate the manufacturing from the engineering. The engineers have to be near the production site to see how it comes. So we lose all of these factories. We're losing all of the intellectual capital that goes with it. That is a huge travesty. And if you want a weak nation, be a nation that makes nothing. The means to our own national defense, the means to our energy security, that would be that would just signal to our economic and global competitors that we are completely willing to cede the territory.
You two are talking about what will likely be the fundamental issue in the 2012 presidential election, the economy. What advice would you have for President Obama as he seeks re-election based on your experience in Michigan, which was during some pretty tough 8 years?
Yeah, let me just jump in quickly. We have this in chapter 10 of our book. We list a bunch of stuff that we think that the U.S. Should learn, at least, you know, in trying to be as humble as possible, because knowing that Michigan still hasn't fully rebounded yet and nobody wants to claim victory. But this is a big, big job. I think one of the things that would be very interesting, the most effective piece of public policy that has come out of Washington over the past few years, in my opinion, has been the educational race to the top. Why is that? It's because there was a little pot of money, and it was a $4 billion pot, which sounds like a lot, but for Washington speak, it's just almost a rounding error. $4 billion pot of money that required all of the states to compete to raise the standards to make sure that every child in this country basically takes a college prep curriculum in high school. All these states changed their standards just because the states are so cash hungry to try to get a piece of this money. That competition for a little pot of money changed a huge amount in education. What if you did something like that in job creation? What if the federal government took a bit of the money that they currently spend in some of the economic development efforts that have been going on for decades and decades that maybe haven't proven the results? I'm all about data. You know that old line, in God we trust, all others bring data. I'm all about the data that it would require to be able to get states to change things that would make them competitive. For example, if you did a race to the top for clean energy jobs. Every state in the country has something to offer, whether it's producing clean energy or producing the means to be able to produce clean energy, the products for it. What if, you know, California is already so far ahead of the rest of the nation, but if you required that states have a certain percentage of their energy that they get from renewable sources, that states have the means to do quick permitting for larger scale solar, for example, if there were changes in the laws that local governments could not otherwise get through, but you had a little bit of pot of money that you dangled out there, you would see a whole array of things changed on the local level to be able to get jobs. I also think, honestly, they should be broadcasting that we are using this whole State Department team, every ambassador in every country, to be able to get jobs to come here. We should be taking advantage of our melting pot in the world and saying, instead, you know, it used to be send us your huddled masses yearning to be free. How about send us your best and your brightest yearning to be successful and have them come here, start businesses here and put our people to work. We ought to be really pushing that as a way of putting our people to work.
And yet you are both lecturing at UC Berkeley, part of the system that's undergoing a great deal of fee increases and funding drops. You have occupiers probably on the way to your classes. You know, what's your take on California's investment level in higher education?
Well, you know, we have a fundamental issue, I think, collectively as a society, and we have this insane cognitive dissonance where on the one hand 75% of Californians say we shouldn't be cutting back on schools, and then how many of them are willing to pay anything? About 25%. So I'm not sure what the 50% are thinking. And, you know, we had a generation of immigrants largely in the 20s, 30s, 40s, certainly where I come from in Detroit, lots of them here in California. And they provided schools for us. Those schools included art, they included music, they included sports. You know, where our daughters grew up, we paid for our kids to play sports. You know, what were we saying to all these other kids in that school system? And, you know, this boogeyman of government is just awful. You know, Mitt Romney's line, it's all government run amok. You know, I think governments, is there room to be tighter? Yes. Is there room for efficiency at Cal Berkeley? Yes, definitely. It's not as tight a ship anywhere near as what Jennifer ran in Michigan. So there's room for efficiency, but there's also an awful lot of room for us to ask, what do we want for our children and grandchildren? And right now, we're not serving them very well. And, you know, when you have the entire Republican delegation in the Congress saying, we won't vote for any taxes on anybody, what are we saying to ourselves? When we are going to make the decision that we're investing enough in ourselves, we're not going to invest anymore. When you have a Republican debate, I don't know, did anybody see the Fox debate? You have nine of these characters up the front of the room. And we're in the midst of this terrible thing where our debt ceiling is frozen and we're about to go into a terrible crisis. We're going to have our bond rating in the United States of America is going to be cut for the first time ever in the history of the country. And you say to these nine people who want to lead the country, if they put a proposal on the table with 10 part cuts and one part revenue increase, would you look at that? And every single one of them said no. Now, this is the party of business. I don't know. Are there business women in the room? Are there business men in the room? Where if you were offered 10 parts of one thing that you were hoping to get from your adversary and you had to put one thing on the table, you would absolutely say no? Not a person at that podium said, well, I would negotiate from there. I'd try for 20 to 1 or 50 to 1. I mean, there wasn't a single person who said that. Now, what kind of inanity is that? That there is, I'll give you an example from Michigan. We had this splendid tourism campaign. You may have seen our ads. Have they been running here in California? Pure Michigan.
So
you hear the voice, the beautiful voice of Tim Allen talking about our water and how it refreshes. So they're extraordinary ads. Now, they've done the research on them, as any company would do that's doing research, right? Are our ads working? Can we tell? And they look at things like website hits. How many people are coming to the Michigan.org? How many people are booking vacations in Michigan? They find out there's this huge variable. For every dollar we spend, we're getting $4 in tax revenue back. Not to mention the businesses that are getting revenue from tourists coming to our great state of Michigan. But it's a net win for us in terms of taxes. We spend a buck, we get $4 back from people doing things. Okay, so Jennifer says, we're only in four states. We're only in the Midwest region. We need to expand the campaign. They say, how are you going to fund this? We don't have any money. She says, well, how about this? Our people go to Florida for vacation, and they pay these incredible fees, taxes, on their rental cars, on their hotels, stuff like that. How about if we have a rental car tax? Turns out that about 80% or 90% of the people renting cars are from where? Not Michigan. Okay? So the Michigan legislature has the ability to tax, where 90% of the people paying
the tax,
$2 a car, 90% of the people paying it don't even live in their districts. They live in some other state. Their people in their districts are paying huge fees when they go to New York, Florida, California, and it's going to return 4 to 1. Now, is that a hard business case?
Apparently,
because they turned it down.
I was going to say, how'd that work out?
Yeah, well,
they wouldn't pass it.
When I was first elected, so I'm a Democrat, I had a Republican House and a Republican Senate and a Republican Supreme Court and a Republican Attorney General and a Republican Secretary of State. So I was the lone Democrat.
Ranger.
In my second term, I had a Democratic House, but the Republican Senate. So every year was always a negotiation, but particularly in my second term, my first term, I could negotiate with the Republicans and they were willing to do it. But in the second term, I don't know what happened. There was a changeover, but all these people signed these pledges and, they refused.
Grover Norquist
I'm
thing.
Telling
yeah.
you.
Yeah.
And, so they refused to raise one single dime of revenue for anything at all. And in fact, in 2007, I was reelected in 2006, 2007, I had to close government down. Shut it down in order to be able to invest in particularly education, which is, of course, the most important part. Hey,
and at that point, you did get a tax
And in that
increase.
Point, we did. I got an increase.
An income tax
But
increase.
Let me just, this is a side thing. If you haven't seen these ads, they're so great. Did you know that Michigan has more miles of shoreline than California? I'm just saying.
This is starting to sound a little like a sales job.
I know, but
here,
you might wonder why we're here in California, if that is the case, right? So we are here because I grew up in California. My parents are in San Carlos across the bay. I went to San Carlos High and I went to Berkeley as an undergrad. And my folks are...
She was Miss San Carlos.
Oh, my God. I didn't say that.
I was true. Not going to bring that up, but of course your husband had to do that.
Oh, wait till we leave here, let me tell you. At any rate, my folks are getting up there and they have some health issues. So it was an opportunity for us to come back, and the University of California offered us a 2-year sabbatical from Michigan, which we were able to take, and we're grateful for that. So that's why we're here.
We just ask that you don't take any of our residents back with you. We need to keep
them. Well, come visit at least, and you won't even be paying a rental fee on your car. So there.
There you go. Governor, what was your most favorite moment as governor, and what was your least favorite? And perhaps this last example may well have already been answered that. But.
Well, let me say the least favorite. Let's just see.
That's easy.
Well, I don't know. There's two.
That's the phone call, no?
Referring to the phone call when the president called to say that he was going to put General Motors into bankruptcy, which was clearly a moment that said that we would never be the same as a state. And that was a big moment. But there was also another moment at the beginning of my term, this Electrolux thing. I was invited to the month that the last refrigerator came off the assembly line. The employees had a gathering that they called the Last Supper. And it was at a big pavilion in Greenville called Clackel's Orchard Pavilion. And I went to it unannounced. I just wanted to be there because I was so still reeling about what we could have done to be able to save this factory. And I go into the pavilion and there's all of these people eating on round top checkered tablecloth tables out of box lunches, and there was a sad band playing, or a band playing sad music, probably a sad band too, but anyway. And I went up and there were thousands of people there, and it was the whole community. And I went up to the first table and this guy comes up to me and he has his two daughters and they're like early teens, and he's got his baseball cap on and his hair is in a ponytail. He's got some tattoos, and he says to me, Governor, he says, I can't remember his name, but he said, I'm 48 years old. Here are my two daughters. He says, I've worked at this factory for 30 years. I went from high school to factory. My father worked at this factory. My grandfather worked at this factory. All I know is how to make refrigerators. And he looked at his daughters and he looked at me. He puts his hand on his chest and he says, so Governor, tell me, who is ever going to hire me? Who is ever going to hire me? And that statement has been asked not just by him, but by millions of workers across this country over the past decade. And if we don't figure that out, that too will cause the demise of our nation.
What was the best moment?
While she's telling us her best moment, let's have folks line up at the microphone who want to ask a live question that hasn't been filtered through me. Here's your chance to come to the microphone and ask questions while she's telling us what was your favorite moment as governor?
Well, there's a lot of great moments in challenge, but I think probably one of the most inspiring was being able to go to Iraq. Because as governor, you're commander-in-chief of your National Guard. And being able to go to Iraq and visit all of the National Guard troops who were there. And when I was there, I asked them to write notes to their family members that I could physically carry home and write their phone number. So when I got home, I called all of their families and read the message from them. And it was, I just was so utterly proud of these great soldiers who were willing to give. Every year we had a gathering at our house for the the loss of the soldiers in Michigan that had, you know, had passed as a result of their service. And those were very sad moments, but it was a great source of pride to be able to see the selflessness of those men and women who were serving.
Well, we have a bashful, absolutely. We have a bashful crowd here.
Nobody has a question?
I think this may be the first time in my entire
career. In the history of the Commonwealth Club.
Excellent, excellent. We have someone to go first.
Talking about Solyndra. So here's an example of a targeted government strategy, in this case loan guarantees, to a selected set of companies.
Yeah.
So, all right, Solyndra failed, and a lot of people were saying that shows that the whole strategy is flawed.
Right.
So the question I have is, do we need to step back a little bit to a broader strategic investment policy that doesn't give such targeted investments with some likelihood of a fair fraction of them failing? Or is the initial strategy right and we could have always expected on the order of 10% failures and that's still the way we ought to go?
So I think that any program can be improved, but I think that to completely back off of providing access to capital to companies that want to take ideas to scale, if we back off entirely, then we are basically saying bye-bye to those companies. Because other countries are doing this all the time. And if we place no bets, then we will lose every time. That particular program had about 40 applications. And so maybe one or two fail. And we know going in that because it is a startup, there is a likelihood. There is not a likelihood. There is a possibility in any given case of failure. But placing no bets ensures loss. This is why this guy was going like this, because they are only too happy to take advantage. And China's losing. They're placing bets, and some of their bets aren't working out. But if we don't have a government strategy for energy, then especially on the demand side, now that's a supply side strategy where you provide access to capital. On the demand side, if we don't create a market for these products, then unlike other countries where they've created markets, then we, again, will lose as a nation.
Thank you.
It's a great question. It is, you know, and you're talking about venture capital, essentially, the most risky money of all. And a lot of what Jennifer and I are talking about is not that investment that no other company will make, but really is investing in a prudent way, investing with the market where there's private money there, investing where, in all of the cases in Michigan, the tax credits only came when the jobs were produced.
Right.
So
tie
Jennifer would announce,
job creation.
You know, we've got 1,000 jobs coming. And there was a commitment of, you know, so many $100 million for that. But the money never came until the jobs were there. So I think, Solyndra, it's a great question. And it is at the extreme. There's a lot we can do short of Solyndra, I think, and that specialized, specific investment in companies.
Yes, sir. Your question.
Okay, this may be a bit off topic. However, as it is, has to do with Michigan, it's not totally off topic. I'm wondering about your successor as governor, Mr. Snyder. I mean, I hear these awful things that he's trying to get rid of, local governments, and he's trying to take over and appoint these, financial managers, and he's taking land from Benton Harbor and on and on. Would you care to comment? Let us know what's going on. How did this happen? You know, what can be done about it?
Well,
do you want me to?
Yeah, go ahead.
I have promised
publicly in Michigan and out of respect to him that I wasn't going to come behind and, you know, second guess. He's been very respectful of me. Even my predecessor, who I disagreed with enormously, he didn't comment on me when I first came into office. Doesn't mean Dan can't comment, but... but I've really tried to not start throwing darts.
I'm only going to comment in a more general way, which is to say that Michigan has some really extreme problems, and the city of Detroit is, you know, a sociological study of extreme tragedy over many, many years from when we had 1.5 million people in the 50s. Our problems began there. There are not technical fixes, and people who come along and think by appointing an emergency financial manager and wiping out everybody's rights to be heard, to collectively bargain, to do all kinds of things, to me, is not a great solution. What we need are people actually figuring out how we adapt to these really complicated problems. And in our cities, in Michigan, not abandon the cities, but really have some sense of common and public good. We have two daughters who've done AmeriCorps and worked in the city and in city schools because they're outraged at what the public offers to public school students who already have enormous handicaps in terms of their neighborhoods, the investment in their parks, the investment in their libraries, their family situations oftentimes. So the answer is not technical answers, and it's not breaking the backs of public labor. It's engaging public labor, as Jennifer did. Jennifer got deeper concessions in Michigan from her public labor unions than Walker or Christie or these other governors have gotten, not by demonizing them, but by bringing them to the table, bringing them to the table as adults and asking them to figure out with her how to solve these problems. So there is still a tendency to think that you can concentrate power in somebody's hands and solve technical problems, which aren't technical problems. They're human problems, and you have to engage people in solving those problems. So does a guy who ran as a tough nerd, that's how he ran his campaign for governor, is that the way you solve complex problems through tough, nerdly answers? I don't know. It might work at Gateway Computers or might not, but it's not the way the city of Detroit or the city of Oakland are going to work their way around the difficult problems that confront them.
The emergency financial managers are, do you guys have that in California, where cities may be going under and the governor has the power to appoint somebody to sort of come in and it removes sort of the mayor from the equation? Do you have that?
No. We don't have that in California.
Okay. So in Michigan, they do. We do. And they had a version of it when I was governor, and I appointed several emergency financial managers. But after I left, they really strengthened the law. And so the emergency financial manager now really does have the power to go in and wipe out contracts and all of that. But I think what Dan is really trying to say is, you know, Detroit, as one example, is really the poster child for deindustrialization of this country. You know, the reason why Detroit is in such tough shape is because the industry completely left. And what you're left with is just, you know, is a city of now 700,000, which was built for a city of 2 million. And what do you do about that? It really has, there has to be a recognition that it's not about cutting schools, which is what's happening, you know, cutting, as though that's going to respond. You know, it's not about that. It's about really investing in the human capital to be able to make it competitive.
Thank you, sir.
What would be your next best job? And are you thinking of staying in California now that you're back?
Well, next best job. Well, I am going to be doing a really cool job starting in January, in addition to teaching at Berkeley, which is that I'll be launching this television show, which is focused on the 2012 election. So Al Gore and Joel Hyatt are co-owners of Current TV. It's a newer cable channel. It's a smaller footprint than, say, MSNBC. And they have, they're building up a primetime lineup. And so Keith Olbermann has the hour, from 5 to 6 here. And Cenk Uygur, who they got from MSNBC, will be launching, his show on December 5th. That will be from, 4 to 5, and then I will be 6 to 7, and then it'll repeat. That same lineup will repeat later in the night. And my show is going to be called The War Room with Jennifer Granholm. Really, it's a tip of the hat to James Carville because it's really going to be election central for political junkies. So if anybody cares to know what goes on behind the scenes, under the curtain, I'm going to pull it back because I've been there and I served with Mitt Romney, I served with Rick Perry, served with John Huntsman. I know these guys. So I want to be able to sort of let people in on what it's like behind the scenes in addition to a few other things. So I think that's going to be a really cool job. That's just a year, so I'll be serving in that role for through the election. After that, who knows? But, you know, Michigan will always be home, and our girls are there, older girls are there, and our son is here.
But in a strange twist of fate, having brought you to Michigan, I'm very happy to be here, and it's an extraordinary place. And we have a son who's a freshman in high school, so I could well imagine staying here.
Hello, excuse my work attire.
It's all good.
So I'm a college student. I go to DVC. I'm a little nervous. And I work. I live with my parents because I cannot afford to not live with them. And I find that a lot of, as you were mentioning, that man at the Electrolux factory, how he said, you know, who will hire me? And I feel like there's a lot of people out there who they never had the chance to get an education. They never right. had the chance to be anything. Who can't move out of their small communities like that.
Right.
And when education can solve so many problems like that, why is it education that is it, have they just cut on everything else that education is the next in line? Or I'm not a poli sci major, so.
Mm-hmm. What are you studying?
Psychology and nursing.
And nursing. Well, that's great.
Yeah.
You'll always have a job if you go into nursing.
People always true. Have health problems, right?
Well, 0 to 18-year-olds don't vote, so start there, 0 to 17. So a huge constituency doesn't vote. You can cut what affects them and they don't even know what's happening to them. So, you know, that's a big piece of it. But I don't know. Times
it's also
tight.
The biggest part of state
it's
budgets.
A big part
Half of
the government.
State budgets are
We're paying for lots of people in prison here, as we were in Michigan,
that's,
rather
yeah,
than
that's
education.
You guys got to fix that, really.
But yeah. You need to ask people that question.
Right.
Why are we doing this?
One of the things that I wonder what you are doing here in California about this, but community colleges are just such an incredible resource for taking people like that guy I was talking about, as well as others who can't afford the higher tuition and, mm-hmm. you know, getting those foundational credits done so you might be able to transfer if that's yeah. what you choose to do. But we started something in Michigan called No Worker Left Behind, where we took all of these federal streams of money that were for workforce training, like the Workforce Investment Act, the Trade Adjustment Assistance Act, and we partnered with our community colleges all over the state. And what we said was to people who are unemployed or underemployed, like that guy, we would pay for 2 years, up to 2 years of community college for them, $5,000 per year, which was the average tuition at the time, $10,000 per person. But they had to agree to be trained in an irrelevant area that would get them a job. And so we divided the state into these workforce development boards, and we had them all decide which areas were important for that, for talent to be grown in. By the time I left office, we had 150,000 people in Michigan who were enrolled or had completed No Worker Left Behind. Because we didn't allow them to get degrees in, you know, French or political science, those are my degrees, so I can say that, we wanted them to get relevant degrees. Because of that, we had 4 times the national rate of job placement once they got out. 82% of the people who got jobs, got them in the area that they were trained in. So my point is that you can really shape workforce training by using these streams of federal money, maybe some state money as well, but partner with the community colleges to have them be your workforce training arm. And I don't know what y'all are doing in California about that, but I think it's a huge opportunity.
And I want to make another really quick point here, which is that with your kids and grandkids and partners and nieces and nephews, you have to get them to question the idea of a J-O-B at all.
What do you
and
mean?
Because there are lots of people who are not trained in lots of other countries who are finding work. And there's lots of ways to make money besides having a job that you fit into. And I'll give you a quick story. I wanted somebody to do a 90-second video for me for my first day of class at Berkeley. And I knew exactly what I wanted. I wanted talking heads saying, "There's no leadership here. It's a fault of leadership. There's a void of leadership. There's a vacuum of leadership. Nobody's leading." I knew I'd heard them, but I couldn't do that. So I went to a website called freelancer.com, and I said, I will pay for somebody to give me a 90-second video like this. Well, within about 24 hours, I had 7 bids from $60 to about $120. There was two from the United States out of the 7. I was getting bids from Romania. I had 2 from Romania. I had 2 from South America. So are our kids who are playing these video games like your grandkids and our son is, who have all this potential and all these resources to learn technology, are they thinking, I could be creating jobs, I could be creating content, I could be filling a need the way somebody 50 years ago said, you know what, they could use a knife sharpener or a fruit wagon on this street. I'm going to go sharpen some knives. Why aren't our kids thinking that way?
More entrepreneurially rather than working for someone.
We have 1 minute left.
Okay.
So
one question, 1 minute. Make it good.
I'm done.
Very quickly. Hi, I'm from Saline, Michigan. Do you know where that is?
Of course.
Do you need a hint?
You got your hand.
Just outside of Ann Arbor. My husband's from just outside Detroit. We actually live here now, but we appreciate your fresh thinking, so thank you. And perhaps we can riff a little bit off the last question, because mine has to do with education as well. We were in Australia in December and met all sorts of interesting educated people from around the world and had lots of interesting discussions about the state of the economy. One of the comments that came out from folks that live elsewhere, I'll say, is their comment was the American education system is like a sausage factory. And your comment earlier struck me. I think it was something about we are, you know, addressing 21st century problems with 20th century solutions. So is there anything that can be done to get students and to get our youth thinking outside of the box and thinking about, you know, bringing up the next crop of leadership?
30 seconds each.
The answer is yes. And if you look at the OECD data about where the United States is now in terms of math scores, reading scores, science scores, vis-a-vis where other countries are, we have stayed the same, and all of these other countries have jumped over us. That's true for college graduation rates as well. What are they doing? They're doing several things. They are lengthening school day to be able to make sure that kids understand it. And if you look at Finland, for example, or Korea, I mean, they are focusing on talented teachers and making sure that the resources are there to select the best and the brightest. It is an honor to be a teacher in many countries that have really focused on that talent. We need to learn from what other countries are doing who have leapt over us. And we have to recognize that just because we have been an exceptional nation doesn't mean we will always be exceptional unless we work at it. And that means changing our pedagogy as well to conform to a global economy.
Very quickly, Dan, your wife took up most of your time. But...
She was great.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much. Our thanks to Governor Jennifer Granholm and Dan Mulhern for their remarks here tonight. We also thank our audiences here and on the radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Lisa Vortebriggen. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.